Before we get going, did we talk about the manna? Did we do that?
Yeah.
Okay, good. So we did the manna, and I think we looked at Jethro. I think that was good. Go to 19. Exodus 19. So the third month they're there. They're in the wilderness of Sinai, it says, and they camp before the mount. Skip down to verse 3. And look, this is where God says, this is kind of my objective, God says. So it's kind of his mission statement. Do you see that there, Abby? Will you read for us verses 3, 4, 5, and 6?
Yeah. And Moses went up unto God, and the Lord called him from the mountain, saying, thus shalt thou say to Jacob, and tell the children of Israel, ye have seen what I did unto the Egyptians, and how I bare you on eagle's wings, and brought you unto myself. Now therefore, if ye will obey my voice indeed, and keep my covenant, then ye shall be a peculiar treasure unto me above all people, for all the earth is mine. And ye shall be unto me a kingdom of priests, and a holy nation.
So this is what I want to do. This is my mission statement. I want to change you guys into a peculiar treasure, a unique and sacred treasure. Good morning. Okay. And then it says, I'm going to kind of change up verse 6 a little bit. Look what he says. He says, I want to make you a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. I'm going to change it to a kingdom of kings and queens. Priests and priestesses, a holy nation. In other words, if you read it that way, this is very much like a temple experience. Notice verse 9. There's going to be a thick cloud that's going to separate God from the people. Notice verse 10. What do they got to do to approach God? Well, they've got to sanctify themselves and they've got to wash their clothes. So we have this idea of washing, clothing, preparing to see God. Verse 12, we're going to set bounds of who can come up. Verse 14, they're going to be sanctified once again and wash their clothes. And then you get to this, Yahweh, the God of thunders, right? Verse 16. It came to pass on the third day of the morning, there were thunders and lightnings and a thick cloud upon the mount. So there's everyone's kind of trembling. And then notice the middle of verse 18, there's smoke there on the mountains. If you go, I thought you were in quarantine.
No, I'm free now. He said I'd take him back on Tuesday.
I'm so glad you're here.
I promise I'm not breaking rules, man.
I'm sorry, because I thought I wouldn't even be able to see you for the rest of the time. So that's good. Whenever I hear you're in quarantine, I'm like sad. So I'm glad we're all here. So the idea is that there, and welcome. I'm so glad to see you. I got your, did you email me or text me? I can't remember. Yeah, so glad you're back. This is great. So there's these zones of holiness in the mountain, okay? So here's the mountain. There's clouds. I'm kind of drawing some clouds up here. I'm recording it for those who can't hear it, so sometimes I'll be describing what I'm drawing. And then the camp of Israel is down here. And Exodus 19, 3 through 6, is I want to make you a kingdom. Well, if you're a kingdom, you got to have a king. And you got to have a queen. But then he says, he uses the plural, a kingdom of kings and queens. So if you've been to the temple, right, that's what God wants to do. He wants you to have dominion, and your dominion is your family, right? This is eternally, I'm packaging this, but it's in there. We just got to look for it. So we have God up here, and then we have the camp of Israel here. That's two zones, but then there's going to be a place right here. And this is the middle of what I'm drawing, the big circle. So there's like a threefold ascent into God's presence. And ritually, that's what the Mishkan's going to be, the tent. The tent is going to be the same model. So I'm drawing the picture of the tabernacle. The Holy of Holies is this zone, the third. The Hekal, or the big house, is the second. And the first is the Ulam. Or the, I'm going to erase all this stuff here so it makes sense. Or the area of the molten sea and the altar of sacrifice. Okay, so we've got this and this. This is the Ulam. Okay, so you come into God's presence just like this. In fact, I think I have a slide that really shows this really well, so I'm going to pull this up just really quick so you can see it. And it's also a metaphor for the plan of salvation, which is kind of cool. Here it is. Okay, it's at the very end, I think. There it is. So what I'm showing you here is this same imagery. So here is the altar and the laver, and we pass these angels, these cherubim or seraphim as they're called. We enter into the Hakal, and then we enter into the Holy of Holies. It's 1, 2, 3. And so here we have the boundary, we have the camp, and then we have the base of the mountain, and then we have the top of the mountain. At the top of the mountain is Exodus 24. I don't have it here, but this is where they feast with God. And so we're going to see this. So seeing it, I think, that's why I can't teach Old Testament without the visuals. You got to see this stuff to see what's happening in the text. Okay, so back to this. We have the thick cloud. And then we have the camps trembling, verse 18, the smoke. Have you ever been to a Catholic mass and there's the guy with going like this with the thing with the smoke? Okay, that's packaging these ideas, because the idea is when you approach God's presence, that the smoke fills the room. So Isaiah writes in Isaiah 6, he says, I was before the veil and I saw the Lord of hosts, and the smoke filled the house. Well, he's standing right here. Because right here, there's a little altar about yay high. And they put incense on it and lit it. And it smelled really beautiful. And so if you're smelling the smoke and you're here, it's like you're about to see God. So if you've ever been to Catholic Mass or Greek Orthodox and they're doing that, they're basically saying you are about to enter into the presence of God. And ritually, what do they do to bring you into God's presence? Well, they give you the bread and the wine. And then Jesus is in you, right? So they're packaging all this stuff too. We don't do smoke in church, but I think that would be cool. I'm sorry, but I just think that would be so cool if the deacons are going like this and they're speaking Latin. I'd be like, this is awesome. So hopefully you don't think I'm apostate. I just had to say that. So I really like that. Okay, so with that being said, let's go to chapter 20. Just throw that out there. Okay. Now, this is going to sound a little bit weird, so just bear with me. Exodus 20 through 24 is following what we call the covenant treaty pattern, and there's something really, really old happening here. So it starts, now we can only go so far, and the way we go as far as we can is written records. So the earliest stuff comes from this guy. Does anybody know who this dude is here? And it's okay if you don't know. It just means you have a life. Okay, so this is called Hammurabi's Stela. It's like 3200 BC-ish, 3000. Somebody could Wikipedia it and correct me, but it's really super old, okay? And I can't read this writing, but there's really smart people who can and have translated this stuff, right? It's a dead language. Did you find the date?
Oh, I wasn't.
It's okay, you don't have to look. But as soon as I say you can Wikipedia, there's always somebody who's like, I got it. But I'll write his name up on the board. Hammurabi. By the way, that's just a really cool name. If you name your kid that, his history teachers are going to think what cool parents he has. And all of his friends will tease him.
Did you not say
a year? Yeah, if you have a year of like when we think that was written, I'm guessing around 3,000-ish.
1754.
Okay, I was way off. Yeah, well, either way, before Moses, and I probably misspelled Hammurabi, but anyway, it says Stella. And the idea is that he's approaching God, okay? And I don't know if you can see this, but what I'm describing here is he's got a rod in his hand, and that's kind of interesting. And then see this ring here? That's a lion. It's like a coiled ring. And the idea that I want to share with you is this idea that the king receives from God the line and the measurement, or the rule and the line. This depends on which translation you read. And the message is this, that you get your bearings from God who gives it to the king. And how do you know you have a good king? This is right out of Tao Te Ching, right? You have justice. You have fairness. That's what a good king does.
Isn't this like eye for an eye kind of stuff?
Yes. In fact, that's in here. And so this is also in Exodus 20 through 24. So now remember how we talked about the positioning and how people read scripture? And over here, We have the fundamentalist camp, and everything in the Bible is 100% just perfect, and it's all from straight from God's mouth to Moses' pen. And over here we have the strong atheist position. My position's right here, somewhere in the middle. That being said, the Book of Mormon really makes this stuff pop. And I'm going to show you what I mean in a second. Meaning that it's inspired, but it's also, so over here, I say inspiration and then man-made. I'm totally okay with both. With the scriptures being gold and clay. Kind of like leading a ward or a church or a bunch of people as slaves out of slavery. And so what I mean by that is this. This code is everywhere in Exodus 20 through 24, but it's not just there. And this is where the Book of Mormon really pops. So here's kind of the general elements. Like, we're not going to read Hammurabi's code in this class. We want to inspire you. But at the same time, I want you to be aware of these issues. So in essence, his code starts with a preamble. I, Hammurabi, have met Shamash, and Shamash has shown me the heavens and the earth, and he's handed me the rule and the line. And then there's this antecedent history. So they give this whole history of, I come from this person who comes from this person, and so forth. And if you read the Book of Genesis, we have lots of that, right? So-and-so begat so-and-so, and so forth. And then the terms of the covenant. If you do this, this will happen. But if you don't do this, this will happen. May Shamash smite you, or may Yahweh get you. After the terms of the covenant, there's formal witnesses. Some of you may have heard phrases like this. Do you swear to tell the truth, the whole truth, so help you God? Well, when you say so help you God, what you're saying is God is my witness. And you kind of do this in court. In the temple, we use a phrase that says, we're going to make covenants before God, angels, and these witnesses. Well, this happens also in the Book of Exodus. And clearly, there's blessings and cursings in Hammurabi's code. And then finally, the recital of the covenant and the deposition of the text. Now, why do I say this makes the Book of Mormon pop? Before we talk about the Book of Mormon, just note that these four chapters in Exodus are following this pattern. But not just Exodus. So is the entire book of Deuteronomy is following this code. And really smart people have written books on this where they're like, you can literally take pieces right out of here and you're like, oh my gosh, he's repackaging Hammurabi, which I'm totally fine with. Same with Joshua. Same with Exodus 19. If you want to just do this on a small scale, you can just read these verses. Four verses does the same thing. Here's where the Book of Mormon pops. If you go to King Benjamin's sermon, King Benjamin's sermon that he gives exactly follows this formula.
In each of these cases, was it done on purpose, or was it like divine inspiration, or is it just...
I think it's yes to all of those. I think that God's inspiring prophets, but they're also using patterns of speech and ways of delivering communication. Think about this. When you give a talk in church, or you're going to present ideas, how do you do it? How do you go about packaging ideas? I see Abby smiling.
Someone at the beginning says, for those of you who don't know me, my name is blah, blah, blah. And if you do know me, it's still blah, blah.
Yeah. In other words, we package our communicating and our ability to speak and to write on our culture and where we come from, right? There's a reason why I don't stand before you and go, like, click. Right? Because it would make no sense to you. But I'm speaking words that you know that come out of culture. We are living in it. And so the reason why, this is why the Book of Mormon pops to me is, here's a 22-year-old kid in upstate New York. And the criticism is that he just made up the Book of Mormon. Well, if he does, first of all, this treaty pattern we didn't even know existed in 1829. Secondly, how could he have guessed so luckily on to make this speech, which is packaged the same way Hammurabi's code is, the same way Exodus 20 through 24, and to make it just fit. And so I just submit that to you, that King Benjamin, that it's not Joseph, that it's King Benjamin, and King Benjamin is steeped in this tradition, and King Benjamin knows how to give an address at the Feast of Tabernacles, if that makes any sense. So once again, Kelly, yes, it's both. And I apologize for my really rough translation. I was trying to speak and those clicks. There's a language that does that. I don't know what the language is. It's in Africa somewhere. Now, before we go any further, if you've been to the temple, tell me if this sounds familiar. Preamble. Welcome to the temple. Today, you're going to see the story of the creation and Adam and Eve. And we want you sisters to look at this as if you're Eve. And brethren, look at this as if you're Adam. See if you can learn. By the way, stay awake. Be attentive. Antecedent in history. Do we go back in history in the endowment? Heck yeah. They're breaking down some antecedent history way back in the beginning of the cosmos. In Greek, it's en arche en he logos. In the beginning was the word, right? The terms of the covenant, do they lay out the terms? Yeah, in fact, in the Ensign, they published them. There's five of them, right? You make five covenants, and it's published. Are there formal witnesses? Yeah. There's witnesses watching you make this. Now, this part's a little bit tricky for some people, blessings and cursings. In August of 1990, I got my endowment. I missed, because the endowment was edited in July of 1990. There used to be specific curses in the endowment, and they took them out. And they're still there, but they're not explicitly stated. What do I mean by that? I'll give you an example. There's a line in the temple where a certain person says, I encourage you to listen to these witnesses, to these people that follow Jesus. And as you heed and give strict counsel, if you pay strict attention to their teaching, they will lead you in the way of life and salvation. I'm kind of paraphrasing. Well, what's the curse? Well, it's implied. If you're not going to listen to them, instead of following in the halakha, the way of life and salvation, what will you get? The opposite. And by the way, the Book of Mormon is doing this all over the place. If you read 2 Nephi 9, Jacob says there's two paths you can pick. You can pick the way of life, or you can pick the way of death. And if you're doing come follow me, I'll do it this way. Moroni says, let me tell you the story about those that enter into the secrets. You have Ether 12 and 13. By the way, the last verse in Ether 12 is, I commend you to seek this Jesus. Enter the veil, see him like I've seen him. And then 13 is the New Jerusalem. We're going to have this awesome kumbaya experience where we have this new city. That's 12 and 13. 14 and 15 of Ether are the way of death, with Cori Antimer smiting off the head of Shiz. We've all read that, right? Where Shiz struggles for breath and he dies, which is a resurrection motif, but it's flipped, it's inverted, it's a parody of the temple. And the entire end of it is the way of death. And so the blessings and cursings are in the Book of Mormon. And anyway, they're there. And then finally, the deposition of the covenant. Now think really carefully. I got to be really careful, but I can say this. When you go to the temple, after you've made the covenants and the witnesses have been laid out and you know what the blessings are, there's a place in the temple where you recite. And you give from your heart, which has been deposited, and it comes out of your heart through your mouth, and you recite the terms in crib fashion and in short notice. And then, well, then you go here. So the endowment is Exodus. Can you see what I'm trying to illustrate here? This stuff's really, really old, and it's not coming out of this 22-year-old kid in upstate New York. And however you want to package it, when Kelly says, well, which is it? I say, yes. It's all of that. So anyway, so without, that's kind of my intro, but we kind of got to get our bearings go. In other words, what I'm trying to say is the Old Testament's really cool, is what I'm trying to say.
Did they do like this type of thing in the tabernacle? Like the main tabernacle and like that side and the Holy of Holies and stuff? Is that like what they did?
Or? So here's my contention. That's not what the Bible says. The Bible, this is what the Bible is telling us today. One guy gets to go here once a year on Yom Kippur, the day of the covering or the day of the atonement. That's what the edited text that is sitting in front of us says. My contention is this. It's been filtered through the Jewish apostasy. Because I'm not going to draw it up here, but I'm just go with me here in your pretend minds. Imagine I take the tabernacle and I build this massive temple called Herod's Temple. The women don't even get to do any of this stuff. You know where you get to go? There's a little building right here, a little space called the Court of Women, and that's where the women go. Can you see why I would say that's been apostatized? And can you see why Jesus says, you've taken my dad's house and you've completely jacked it up? And if you read how Jesus treats women, he does not tell the women, go over in the corner where I don't have to see you. No, the witnesses to the resurrected Jesus are women. They're the first person to see him are women. And women are constantly witnessing of Jesus. And so my contention is that it's been messed with. I'm just going to leave it at that. Okay? So this, to me, includes all of God's kids. And so when it says right here, the terms, I want to make you a kingdom of priests and a holy nation, that's why I always say it's a kingdom of kings and queens. There is no kingdom without a queen. I have no children without Sister Day. I have no kingdom. I have nothing. I'm the king of myself, like, which is really lame. I can sit in a man cave and watch sports. Now, that sounds fun for a day. But if I had to go to heaven without Sister Day, it wouldn't be heaven. It'd be lame. So, does that help? I don't know if that helps. Okay. So I guess what I'm trying to say is we're reading a broken book, but as broken as it is, it's pretty cool. And I hope that doesn't sound bad. A person came to me one time and said, when you say the Bible is a broken book, you sound like an apostate. I'm like, no, I'm trying to just see what it is. Okay, well, Ten Commandments. So look at verse 3. Remember how we talked about monolatry? Can you see it in there? How? Yeah, he's not saying there aren't other gods. He's saying, don't put any before me. Now, I don't believe in Zeus and Mithras and those kinds of things, but anciently, those guys did. And so what Jehovah is saying is, don't put those guys in front of me. We can talk about any one of the Ten Commandments or none of them or all of them. This is your class. So what kind of direction would you like to go in? Do you want to just skip 20? Do you want to look at specific things? Do you want me just to start talking and as questions hit you, you like raise your hand? How do you guys want to handle this? Because you got up in the morning to come here. Any takers?
Does honoring my father and my mother mean that I have to take care of them when they get old?
Ooh. That is a great question. Honor thy father and thy mother. Will you read it? Will you read it for us?
Also, follow-up question. Does that mean I have to agree with them with what they say? Honor thy father and thy mother, and thy day shall be long upon the earth, which the Lord thy God giveth thee.
Okay, now first you need to know this. I'm going to skip it to honor your father and mother really quick. And I think I have a slide on it. If I don't, there it is. Okay. You have to cross-reference this with Deuteronomy 21. Read that for us. This is going to blow your mind. Yeah. Deuteronomy 21:18. Then the father and his mother are going to lay hold on him. Why? This rebellious kid. We're going to lay him, hold on him. We're going to bring him out unto the elders of the city to the gate. Now here's the deal. The gate is where public business was transacted. We don't have this today. We just go to KSL.com, right, and I buy something. Or the courthouse. So the gate, you're laughing. Abby's laughing. Why are you laughing? I love it.
Well, it just says that they take him to this public place and then they stone him.
Yeah, then they kill him. This, our son, is stubborn and rebellious, and he will not obey our voice. He's a glutton and a drunkard. So what do? They stone him. Verse 21.
I'm just saying about what that would look like today.
Yes. Now, here's the thing. When you ask this question, that's what Deuteronomy says. But Jesus flips the convention, and he flips it upside down, and he tells you the story of the prodigal son. The prodigal son, was he a glutton and a drunkard? Yes, he spent his money on prostitutes. He went to his dad and said, give me my inheritance, to really understand the shame that this would involve. The law was that you don't sell clan land. It stays in the clan. It stays in the family. So the son says, Dad, I want my share, and I want it converted into cash. Well, to get it, there's not a lot of options. The father probably had to sell a chunk of his land, which would have been publicly humiliating that he's selling clan land, then give the money to his son, who then spends it on prostitutes and alcohol. if there's anybody who fits Deuteronomy 21, it's this kid. And what does Jesus say happens to the kid? When the kid comes home, what do they do? He gets a party. They kill the fatted calf. The father puts the ring on him and a new robe and bathes him and cleans him and says, "Welcome home." And can you see why the Jews would be freaked out? They're like, this guy has suffered public humiliation. This son is worthy of death. So what is Jesus telling us about Deuteronomy 21? Now, I don't know. I don't know the mind of God on this, but I read this and I see Jesus going like this. Guys, we certainly don't take all this literally, right? Now, that's my teaching on this. I certainly would never advocate killing your kid then or now, but it's in there. And then we got to go down that path. Like, why is it in there? But when Kelly asked the question, do I have to take care of my parents if I don't like them or they don't like me, or is it really my job to pay their bills? I think that question really depends on what time period you're in and what are your expectations. So for example, if we lived in China and we followed this, like, would they look at this different than a Westerner?
Yeah, they never get to put their parents in a home.
Never. Never. In fact, my brother dated a gal from China one time. And after like the second or third date, she's like, "I really like you, Rob, but I can't date you anymore." And he said, "Why?" He's like, "I really think we got something going here." And she's like, "You're too white." And he said, "What do you mean?" And she's like, "Well, I've asked you about your family." And she's like, "You talk about them, but you don't live with them. You haven't seen your mom in a year. You're too white." And he's like, "I don't understand." And she's like, "Well," and then she starts explaining the culture of the family. And he's like, "Oh, I see what you're saying." She's like, "Yeah." So it's kind of complicated. I don't know what the answer is. But I know this. For each and every one of you, with your family and your parents, and you're honoring them, I think the Spirit will dictate to you how you package this. So for example, to one of my friends who said, "It will kill my mom if I join the church." He honored his mom by joining the church, and he still goes to Catholic Mass when he's with his mom. And he's just like, I just can't do it. He's like, "It'll kill her." Now, I'm not going to judge him. I don't know what it's like to walk in his shoes, but this is a guy that loves Jesus, but he loves his mom. I'm not saying he's right. I'm not saying he's wrong. I don't know. I don't know the answer. So that's such a good question. Any thoughts on that? Anybody have any way that you package it? See, my job as a teacher, I teach the principle and I let you package it. How do you honor your parents? Some of you are like, "I don't like my parents." I hope you all love your parents. As a parent, I want my kids to think I'm pretty cool. I want them to visit me when I'm old. Yeah.
Trying to call them and text them back, and like, when they ask me to come home on the weekends, instead of being annoyed, just going back home.
They love you. Well, because you're their child. They love you. You're just like their star. When my son, my married son, comes over, I put it down everything. I'm like, "Sit down, talk to me." It's so good. Anyway, I love it. Let me just say this. All the commandments, there's so many different ways to package them and look at them. If there's any other one you want to look at, that's great. Or I'll just start talking about some of them, or we can move on. Like I said, it's your class.
Okay, so mine kind of isn't about a specific commandment, but like you get verses like Nephi killing the Laban.
Yeah.
So how do you know if you can, like, there are certain instances where people break commandments.
Yeah.
So how does that work?
Isn't this fun? So I could spend a lot of time talking and then it begin and end with, "I don't know," or I could just say, "I don't know." So I'll package it this way. According to Nephi, and according to Old Testament law, because of the steps that Laban covered, Nephi is very particular in his record to show you, Laban sought to kill me unjustly. Laban stole my property. Laban bore a false witness. Laban was an enemy to God. By the time he covers that formula, he shows you from a ritual perspective and from a legal perspective that Laban was worthy of death. But even then, he doesn't want to kill him, and God says, "You do it." And so from Nephi's perspective, he's like, he fit all the legal justification. God told me to do it twice, and I would rather follow God than have God smite me. That was probably Nephi's logic. Even then, to our Western mind, it kind of blows our mind. As a missionary, right, if you have your investigator read this, they might have some problems. I had a lady named Judy one time, and Judy Tipton, she read this, and she called me up on the phone, and she said, Elder Day, I can't read the Book of Mormon anymore. I'm like, why? And she's like, because it advocates violence. She's like, this is a guy cutting off a guy's head. And I says, well, how familiar with the Old Testament are you? I wasn't that familiar. I was 19. And she's like, well, I've learned about it at Sunday school. So quickly on the phone, I took her to the narrative in Samuel. Now, we always talk about David hitting him with a rock. But what happens after that? After Goliath gets whacked in the head, then what? I asked her because I didn't know. Like, I was like, and I was frantic. I'm like, Heavenly Father, help me. And I'm skimming. Yeah. And at the end of the chapter, some of you as missionaries are like, yep, I've had that experience. In the end of the chapter, it talks about David lopped his head off and he stuck it on a pole. And we read that on the phone. I'm like, was David a man of God? She's like, yeah. And I'm like, what do you do with this? And she's like, I don't know. And I said, me neither. She read the rest of the Book of Mormon. She got baptized. So I'm 49 years old and I swim a lot and I don't know. It's a great question. Okay, we're going to do this one just for fun. Go to 20 again. Look at Sabbath day. See that there? Jason, read it for us. Read 6, chapter 20, verse, excuse me, that's not a 6. I'm dyslexic. 9. Read 9, 10, and 11.
6 days shalt thou labor and do all thy work. For the seventh day is the Sabbath of the Lord thy God. And if thou shalt not do any work, thou nor thy son, nor thy daughter, thy manservant, nor thy maidservant, nor thy cattle, nor thy stranger that is within thy gates. For in 6 days the Lord made heaven and earth, the sea and all that is in them, and rested the seventh day. Wherefore the Lord blessed the Sabbath day and holiday.
Okay. So this commandment can bring up a bunch of questions. What does it mean not to do any work? Could a roofer put around his garden on the Sabbath? Like, what if you're a roofer and you're just in the garden? Can you plant or weed? Could a farmer climb up on his roof to fix it on the Sabbath? By the way, their Sabbath was the seventh day, which was Saturday, right? And if all work was forbidden, what about cooking? Could a mother cook for her family? What about cattle? Was it forbidden to milk the cows? Now, if you've ever had cows, you don't want to skip milking day. That's kind of scary. Further, Jeremiah says that even carrying your burdens is a burden or forbidden on the Sabbath. Don't carry your burdens. Well, what's a burden? Is it a sack of grain? What about me? Is it a book? Can I not carry a Bible in my hand? Moreover, this verse seemed to imply that going out of one's house without a burden was permitted. Exodus 16 says, let no man go out of his place on the seventh day, which... well, is that correct? Then Isaiah said something that caused people even more anxiety. Isaiah 58:13 says to not do this. Don't even speak your own words. And so they're like, what do we do with that? Does that mean I can only read scripture? Does that mean I can't say what I think? What does that mean? So then you get to the book of Jubilees, and it says that a man who works on it is to die. Well, so does Exodus. Any man who desecrates this day, who says anything about work on it, according to Jubilees, that he's going to go on a trip, or he's going to sell or buy something, or who draws water or lifts a load, well, they're breaking the Sabbath day. So if I'm a merchant and I'm talking about, well, we're going to get a shipment of myrrh, breaking the Sabbath gets worse. When does it start? Does it start when the sun comes up? Or the preceding midnight. So I've got this fun joke, right? BYU is playing Notre Dame, score is tied, you're on the 1 yard line, and it's 11:59 at night. In 59 seconds, do you run the play? Do you break the tie? Or do you just call it a tie and walk off the field? Now, I'm not asking you to answer it, but these are the questions people have. Like, if BYU wins on Sunday, did the win happen? Or is it a loss? Okay, we don't know. But it was a question that they had. If they were supposed to do no work, they need to know when the hour starts, right? And then Nehemiah 13, well, is it before dark on Friday? Seems to hint towards that. So it goes further. This Caesar Augustus, he said that the Jews may follow their customs in accordance with the law of their fathers. They need not give bond or appear in court on the Sabbath or the day before, the ninth hour. So according to this Caesar, he's like, you know what? 3 p.m. on Friday, you Jews go home, go keep the Sabbath. But is that when it starts? Like I said, we could go on and on. What about travel? Numbers 35 seeks to limit it to about 1,000 cubits. Have you ever heard the phrase like the number of steps? That's what this slide's talking about. Like those scriptures actually designate, well, that's how far you can go. Like I said, I don't want to belabor the point. I think I've already hammered it enough. So how do we apply it? That's the question, Daniel. Will you read this for us? Teachers who are commanded. This is Elder Oaks. This is the answer. I love that. For me, a teacher, I should probably forego rules and talk about the principles. So then he says, once a teacher has taught the doctrine and the principles from the scriptures and the living prophets, such specific application or rules are generally the responsibility of individuals and families. Well-taught doctrines and principles have a more powerful influence on behavior than teaching them a bunch of rules. When we teach gospel doctrine and principles, we can qualify for the witness and guidance of the Spirit to reinforce our teaching, and we enlist the faith of our students in seeking the guidance of the same Spirit and applying those teachings in their personal lives. When he said this in 1999, as a teacher, I can't tell you the weight that I felt lifted off my shoulders. As a teacher, I would stand up, because I've taught before 1999, I'd teach the Sabbath day, and I would have kids try to pin me, and I felt like I was Jesus in front of like the opposing Sanhedrin and Pharisees, and I'm like, I don't know. Classic example, this is a true story. In the 90s, there was this famous member of the church who won Super Bowls, and he played for BYU, and then he was a quarterback for the 49ers, and his name was Steve. Wow, I'm old. Steve Young. Wow. Anyway, he won a bunch of Super Bowls. But there was another guy who went to BYU, and his name was Eli Herring. Nobody knows his name. And the reason why you don't know his name is because he was offered a first-round pick by the Raiders to make a ton of money to play line, and he turned it down because he didn't want to break the Sabbath. And he got a job as a math teacher making $26,000 a year. So he went from potential to be a millionaire to making $26,000. And when interviewed by the paper, he was like, you know what, I'm just trying to follow Jesus. And my students would say, well, which one is it, Brother Day? Is Steve Young a good Mormon or is Eli Herring? And I'm like, and I was sweating. And I look at what Elder Oaks is saying, and what's he essentially saying to you? Yeah, you've got to let the Spirit dictate to you how you package this.
I think it's also like, not to be like, but like, I feel like it's what we talk about a lot with like ritual and getting so entrenched in ritual that we forget the reasons why we do it.
Amen. Amen. So in reading Exodus, I just beg you to do that. I beg you to read it with one eye on the gold, one eye on the clay, but both eyes on Jesus. What does Jesus want me to see? Because I think that really makes things pop and just unpacks a ton of stuff. And so, like I said, we can do this with all the commandments, some of them or none of them, but I wanted at least to use this as like a case study of how to approach it. Okay. Thank you. Great comments. Anything you want to talk about? Don't kill. I like this one. This one's fun. It's really short. Taking God's name in vain. Anciently, it meant to not make a false oath using his name. Today, we use it and we package it with swearing, right? I hit my thumb with a hammer. I have a fun meme where it shows Jesus and he's standing behind a wall and he pops over like this. It's so cute. And then underneath it, it says, I heard what you said when you hit your thumb with a hammer. It's a great meme. I send it to my kids all the time if they ever say anything. But my point is, that's how we package it today, but that's what it meant then. And so that's why when Martin Luther was so against indulgences, to Martin Luther, it was taking God's name in vain. How can you as a church get wealthy off people paying for their sins? You're taking God's name in vain. And I would say Martin Luther is onto something. So there's lots here. Oh, you want me to make a decision? I had a really interesting conversation in my office yesterday with one of my students who asked me that. He says, what's your position on swearing? And I said, so much of it is cultural. And so I said, you know what, you've got to follow your cultural norms in your marriage, in your life, in your family. I'll give you an example. So the Apostle Paul said, he gives this huge discourse in Corinthians. There was a big contention in the church. If Heather buys meat that's been sacrificed to Zeus and she's having a barbecue, do I go? She's a Christian. I'm a Christian. Paul says, go to the barbecue, man. By the way, Heather's a great cook. But what if Jason's like, hello, it was sacrificed to Zeus. What are you, some kind of pagan? And I say, no, dude, we're having freaking steaks. And Jason's like, you don't even believe in Jesus. Right? Then what does Paul say I should do? Don't go to the barbecue. That's what Paul says. Not that the barbecue's bad, but I don't want to lead Jason astray. Now, how does that apply to language? I know, it's hard, it's tricky.
Like,
I know, it's hard. Tell me why you don't like it.
Because, I mean, like, sir, I don't know. I guess you're talking like certain cultural norms. I get it. I get where you're coming from. But it's also annoying.
It is annoying. Can I give you another one?
Yeah, sure.
So when the whole COVID thing and Black Lives Matter came out, all institute teachers got a letter. And the letter said, as a church employee, you are not to get political. Like, I'm not supposed to stand here and say, Black Lives Matter is awesome or Black Lives Matter is bad. It says you be neutral. In other words, I'm not to speak about it. Why? Why would I get that letter?
Because the church doesn't want liability.
Yeah, and by the way, statistically, maybe not at the U, maybe it's more than 50-50, but if I come out and I say, this is stupid, whatever political position, what have I done to half my audience? Yeah, I've alienated half my audience. And now you're like, I'm not going to go to Institute and learn about Jesus. He's a Democrat, or he's a Republican, or he's a Libertarian. Now, on my Twitter feed, I say fun stuff, but I keep it funny. I keep it light, like the meme. I do fun little memes, like, because I just can't, I have to laugh, right? But my point is, I'll give you another example. So, gosh, I got to be careful with this example because I can't be specific. But I have a specific opinion about COVID and masks and those kinds of things. And I'm in a group of people after church that are my really close friends, and I'm starting to open my heart and my feelings about it. And then another guy walks up, and he's not in my inner circle of trust, and he walks up and he's listening, and I shift way down, and I keep it light. Now, why do I do that? Am I a hypocrite? Some of you are like, yes, you are a hypocrite. Right? I don't want to offend him.
Okay, that was a better example.
Thank you, Heather. Yeah, yes.
But isn't offense on their part of the choice?
That's Elder Bednar, so he's on the other end, and we could go round and round on this, right?
Yeah, we could go round and round.
Yeah.
You know that there's an Yeah, you don't go around being a crappy person and be like, oh, you're wrong.
Yeah, see, this is where we're having a real conversation. This is so good.
But if you have beliefs that you truly believe in,
yeah,
why would you suddenly not talk about them just because you're worried about
I still talked about them, but I softened it incredibly. So this is what my wife's taught me. I've been married now since 1994, and I'm really dumb. I'm about as dumb as a box of hammers, but after all these years of marriage, I'm starting to learn. And this is what my wife says to me all the time. She says, Mike, it's not so much what you said, it was your tone. And for years, I was like, I don't care. What I said was right. And she's like, there you go again. You got that tone. And so over the years, I've tried to soften up my tone. Now, sometimes I sound really dogmatic. So, for example, when I did that whole 10-minute spiel on here's the laws of Hammurabi and here's the way. And to me, that's just how it is. Well, you may be sitting there going, I don't care what you say. I think you're wrong. And you know what? I have to tone it down to where I'm open to these ideas. And that's part of what college is, right? College is this idea of you're going to be exposed to ideas that maybe you don't like. And you know what? That's good for you. It's good for us to be exposed. If all we're hearing is what we already believe and we're living in our own echo chamber, maybe we're doing college wrong or relationships wrong. And by the way, this is not a lesson on marriage, but can I just tell you, being married to a woman has really helped me see things different. She'll say something to me, I'm like, what? You said, how did you get that? And she's like, well, do you want to know or do you want to be right? And I'm like, no, tell me. And after an hour of her explaining, I'm like, you know what? That makes sense. I never would know that if I wasn't married to a woman. If I was married to a dude, we'd both be like, yeah, we're right. So there's something about that, which is good. Anyway, sorry, that was a little marriage dirt road we went down. Yeah.
I think that just like is the whole point of being a good Christian, is you can have your beliefs, but you're not supposed to go and like diminish somebody else's beliefs because they're different. Like your whole, like our whole point and purpose is to be kind and be open to other people and to have them feel the Spirit in their own way, whether or not it's they're going to become like a member of the church or anything. Our whole job is to just be there for people, and we can't do that if we're not welcome and opening and willing to learn about other people.
And so, Riley, I think you're bringing up this point, and I think it's also kind of crashing up against Callie's point, which is, how do we do that? How do I stand and say marriage is between a man and a woman, where some people are like, I just got offended, and I don't know how to do it other than maybe our tone? But I think no matter what you do, some people are going to be offended, but at the same time, you need to stand up, and at the same time, you have to be kind, and I certainly don't have the answers, but I think one of the answers is love, meaning how we reach out to them. And by the way, Exodus is not teaching this. In Exodus, it's like, oh, you guys believe different, and Yahweh's like, yeah, you got to kill them. Sorry, you got to die. And so that's why I'm like, okay, as much as it says that, I'm like, I certainly don't take that literally today, right? We don't go, can you imagine President Nelson be like, you've been called on a mission and here's your gun. Go kill them, please.
I think that being bold in what you believe and loving other people might seem like it's a dichotomy.
It can be.
I really think that those can exist at the same time.
I just want to high five you with air high five. Ready? The COVID high five. Becca.
I think a lot of times, like, you know, and who's going to be inherently political to
do that. See, you can say it, I can't.
Sure. But I think, like, there's a difference between me saying, well, you know, I am not going to get married to a woman based on my Christian beliefs or whatever.
Right.
And then going to someone else and saying, well, you as an atheist or as a person who's gay can't get married, you know, like, and I get that it gets all tied up in government and stuff like that, which, you know, like,
it's messy.
Yeah, it's messy, but I think there's a big difference between saying, well, like, you know, I'm not gonna do it, but I'm not gonna judge someone else for doing it. I don't think, you know,
it's a challenge.
Yeah, I wouldn't judge someone for most things except for maybe like murder. I feel like that one's fine to judge on. Generally.
Yeah. I can't believe I'm saying this, but we are out of time, and yet we are not going to skip this, but I just want to put this in your pocket, so it's right here before we leave. There's so many things. The point of these four chapters is this. There are many who are brought into God's presence, and in the 24th chapter, they sit down and they break bread. We are going to do this in like a few days. Thanksgiving is the pilgrims' repackaging of the Jewish holiday Feast of Tabernacles, and the Jews are getting Feast of Tabernacles from this. So when we sit down with our families and break bread, it's all about this relationship with each other and with God. And as a closing thought, if my son came to me and said, Dad, I'm going to go do this stuff, which is against what I believe, I'm going to preserve the relationship. I'm going to break bread with my son because if I cut him off, I have no influence. And I think that's a message that we can package through the lens of the prodigal son. The prodigal son is in direct contradistinction to Deuteronomy 21. They're not the same story. They're opposites. And Jesus is packages. So how do I package the Old Testament? I overlay it with two lenses at least. I overlay it with the lens of Jesus, and I overlay it with the lens of the restoration. See what I'm saying? These texts have been reformed. Jesus reformed them, and then Joseph has reformed them. And let us also reform them. That's what it means for us to enter the text, as we read it and we package it for ourselves with the Spirit. That's my testimony. In the name of Jesus Christ, amen. I want to thank you for, I love, it's spirited, but I feel like we're all friends. And we can disagree, but it's like, okay, because like, I don't know. We're kind of in this together. So, so good. Do I volunteer for a prayer? So good. Okay, thank you, Danny.